The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. I just heard that Stuart Woods died on July 22nd, and his family did not release this information until almost a week later. So the obituaries for him really haven't even run, but I did go into his Wikipedia page, and I get the sense reading it, it's so detailed that the information came directly from him. So I think he would approve of my sharing some of it with you. Stuart Woods was born in Manchester, Georgia. And he was 84 years old when he died. He went to Ireland in 1973 and took up a new hobby of sailing. And he was in a lot of races sailing. In the fall of 1974, his grandfather died and bequeathed him enough money to buy a yacht suitable for a race. And he got a specially made yacht and became quite an avid sailor. Then he published his first novel. He wrote some nonfiction first, but he published his first novel, Chiefs, back in March of 1981. The story was inspired by a police chief's badge he found in his grandmother's home. The badge was stained with blood and pockmarked by buckshot. It had belonged to his grandfather, who died wearing it 10 years before Woods was born. He submitted the first 100 pages and an outline to three publishers who all turned him down before W.W. Norton bought the publishing rights for $7,500. He later stated it was a mistake to sell the book unfinished, as he could have got much more money had it been completed. 20,000 copies of the book were printed in hardback, but Norton did little to promote the book. He contracted with Bantam to print the paperback edition. In 1983, it was adapted into a TV miniseries starring Charlton Heston, Danny Glover, Billy Dee Williams, Stephen Collins, and John Goodman. He went on to publish many, many books, many bestsellers. In fact, at the time I interviewed him 20 years ago, he was publishing a couple of books a year. By the time he died, he was publishing up to a half dozen books a year. Incredibly prolific. And he published a memoir called An Extravagant Life just last month. And he has more books coming out later this year. Really a very productive writer, even as he got older. He kept accelerating. His publisher said, could you put out 3 books a year, Stuart? He said, yeah, sure, no problem. And they said, could you put out 4 books a year? And he said, okay, yeah, sure, I can do that. And he just kept cranking them out and didn't even have a co-author, as far as I know. I talked to him 20 years ago. He came to the station, and he had a book out in one of his other series. His most popular one featured Stone Barrington. But this was a series that only ended up having about 5 books in it. And it was not as popular as Stone Barrington, but he perennially was on the bestseller list. And just an amazingly, amazingly busy guy, Stuart Woods, right up to his death on July 22nd. And when I interviewed him, we were in the middle of a membership campaign. And he came in not knowing that we were doing that. And I got him to sign some books for our listeners during that membership campaign for pledges. And he was willing to do that. I don't think he was super excited about it, but he was willing to do that. And he was an amazing guy, and we'll miss him. I know a lot of you have read his books, and we're going to bring you my interview now with Stuart Woods, recorded 20 years ago, as we remember him on the Best of the Book Nook.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Stuart Woods. His new book is called Blood Orchid, and he rushed into the studio because he almost ended up in our mailroom. It's just one of those classic misdirection things, kind of like what he does in his books, where he kind of sends you down the wrong trail, and by the time you get to the end, maybe you figure out what's going on. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You've been doing this for a while.
A while, yeah. My first novel was published in 1981, and this is my 25th novel.
How did you get into this?
My mother taught me to read a year before I went to school, and I became a voracious reader as a child, and as a result of that, all I ever wanted to do was write.
Were you reading the classics?
I was reading Mark Twain and Dickens, to the extent that those are classics. But I was reading a horse and dog story every month from the Junior Literary Guild, and when I ran out of those, I started reading my mother's Literary Guild selections. Mm-hmm. And I just loved to read from the moment I learned how.
What was the first book that you had published?
Oh, the first book. I thought you were going to ask me the first book that I read. The first novel that I had published was Chiefs, and I published two nonfiction books before that, a memoir and a travel book.
When did you finally lock into the thing that has turned you into such a popular author?
Well, I was working in London in 1973 in the advertising business as a writer, and I'd been doing that for 13, 14 years, and I decided to go and write the novel I'd been thinking about for years and years, and I moved to Ireland, where some friends found me a flat in a stable yard of a castle on the west coast. And I began to write my novel, and then I learned to sail, and the novel went to hell for several years while I just sailed all the time. And then finally I got a contract for it, and I had to finish it since I'd taken their $7,500. And I finished it, and it was published in 81.
I had Ed McBain on this program about a year ago, and I said, Ed, I said, when you write one of these books that you write, what are your prerequisites? What do you have to do? What do you have to get done right away? He says, well, he says, the first couple of pages, he says, you've got to have a corpse. And I was reading your book, and first page or second page, boom, we've got a body. And I think the third page there was a body, and there was another body shortly after that.
Well, it isn't always that way. I don't always start out with two murders and an attempted murder. It just happened in this case. Evan Hunter, who is, of course, Ed McBain, is a friend of mine, and just exchanged emails with him yesterday. He's had a little surgery and recovering nicely. Evan Hunter isn't his name either. He has an Italian name, but
right.
His agent advised him to change it when he first began to write.
Yeah, what's his original name?
I can never remember it, but it's...
It's definitely Italian.
Yes, it's very Italian.
Mm-hmm. It's like Lou. It's Lou something.
I don't remember.
Well, he's an amazing guy. He's doing okay?
He is, yes.
Yeah, in fact, he was supposed to be here a couple years ago, and I think he had a bypass, and he didn't come, and then he came a year ago, and he was here on September 10th,
mm-hmm.
last year, September 10th. And this is a New York writer, and of course, the next day...
Oh, yes, I remember he had to cancel his book tour because of 9/11.
He flew to Chicago, and he got to Chicago. He saw what was happening. He hopped right in a car and drove to New York.
Hmm, smart move.
How'd you get
I would have hopped right into a chartered jet and billed my publisher for it.
I don't think the jet would have been going anywhere, though. Tell us about the new book.
Well, this is the third in what has become a series featuring a woman named Holly Barker, who is the chief of police in a small Florida town called Orchid Beach. And she and her trusty Doberman Pinscher, Daisy, and her retired Army Sergeant father, Ham, sort of seem to work together to get out of the terrible situations they find themselves in. Holly was originally an Army officer. She was a major who commanded a company of MPs, and she and another female officer had sued their commanding officer for sexual harassment, and when he was acquitted at the court-martial, she found her path to promotion blocked by his friends, so she left and took the police job. Holly's a tough cookie.
And her dad is Ham.
Right.
And in this book, as we get into it, we have some very suspicious things going on with land development. Now,
yes.
Now, why did you fix on this particular aspect?
Well, it's an echo to the first novel. There were also suspicious things going on with land development at that time. There was a development called Palmetto Gardens, which was rather large, had three golf courses, but only had 50 houses. and nobody could figure out how they were running it. But since they contributed about 20% of the community's tax revenues, nobody was anxious to ask too many questions. Turns out there was something terribly illegal going on there, which Holly managed to uncover. And as a result, the feds, under the RICO Act, confiscated the property. And as Blood Orchid opens, they are selling it. They're accepting bids. Two of the bidders are shot dead or killed, and a third one is an attempt on his life. And it goes on from there.
Was that a South American drug cartel that owned it?
Yes, they were using it. Well, I won't tell you what they were using it for, okay, because people, just, there are one or two people out there who haven't read Orchid Beach yet, and they might like to be surprised.
Is that on paper now?
Yes, it's been in paper for some time. Orchid Blues, the second book, has just come out in paper.
How do you get the idea for a series?
Well, they don't start out as series. This didn't. I got this idea when I received a newsletter from a yacht club I belonged to in England. I used to live there, and I, for sentimental reasons, have kept my membership. And it's just a sheaf of mimeograph pages. They think they have the last mimeograph machine in the Western Hemisphere. And the last page is always something called wants and offers, or classified ads. And there was an ad for a Labrador Retriever for sale, and the headline was Excellent Working Bitch. And I thought, wow, which is a dog training term, as it turns out. And I thought, wow, I can get a novel out of that. That's a terrific title. So I wrote six chapters and a short synopsis and sent it off to my publisher with a note saying, if you don't want to publish it under this title, I'll take it somewhere else. So they agreed to do that somewhat reluctantly. And then I finished the novel, and I got a call from someone at HarperCollins, who at that time were my publishers, saying that some of the salespeople were concerned that the book might not get as much display space with the word bitch in the title. And I said, you know, a bitch is a female dog, and I'll put a dog on the cover. Will that fix it? And they said no. And I reminded them there was at that moment a book being sold called simply Bitch, which had made no canine references at all. And that was getting a lot of display because of its title rather than in spite of it. But logic didn't work. And I finally worked my way up to the brand new CEO of the company. And the two of us argued for an hour before she suddenly became aware that her company had signed a contract guaranteeing to publish it. So she said she would publish under that title, but I should not expect the kind of promotional and advertising budgets that I was accustomed to. So I capitulated and called it Orchid Beach, which was the town in which the action took place. The second was Orchid Blues, and now we've got Blood Orchid. So I seem to be stuck with a series of Orchid titles. But I suppose it could have been worse. I could have been stuck with a series of bitch titles, which might have been tougher.
Well, life's a beach. If you're lucky, life's a beach. My guest is Stuart Woods. The new book is Blood Orchid. The thing I noticed about the book, Stuart, and I must admit, I'm one of the great unwashed. I had not read your previous work. It's the first book I read by you, and your pacing. You say to yourself, oh, I'm just going to read another chapter. And next thing you know, you've got another 50 pages, and it just goes boom, 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 and the pacing's incredible. How do you do that?
I'm glad you think so. I'm not entirely sure, and I regard it as a kind of magic, and I'm afraid to inspect it too closely for fear that it might go poof and vanish. So I know enough. I don't want to know more. I don't need to know more about how it works. And now I write a chapter at a sitting. The next day I reread that chapter, make small corrections, and that sort of slingshots me into the second chapter. I try to lead from one chapter to another to keep people moving. And when I finish the book, I don't even reread it. I just send it off to my editor.
Wow. Orchids. We've got a guy who's introduced early in the book who is into orchids. And I was suspicious of this guy when I first came on him. Things seem to be pointing at him, but you direct us other places. And, of course, this is the kind of book where you really can't give too much away. But at the very beginning of the book, developers are getting killed right and left, and someone tries to kill him. Mm-hmm. And to me, being suspicious, I thought, this is some sort of misdirection going on here.
Well, you'll have to finish the book and see. I'm not going to tell you.
I did finish the book.
Oh, okay, sorry. Well, orchids in themselves have a rather rambunctious history in this country. People become obsessed with them. And there was a wonderful book called The Orchid Thief some years back that talked about in Florida, how there are swamps that no one is supposed to enter. They're off limits where very, very rare orchids grow, and people wade in there in their hip boots and fight the alligators and the snakes to get at these orchids, and they try to breed them. And it's really quite an amazing thing. I wish I'd had more time to get more into the orchid thing, but I didn't.
What keeps you going?
Well, I got a mortgage, just like everybody else, you know. I got to eat. But I wouldn't be happy if I weren't working, I think. If I miss a day's work, I feel guilty. If I failed to write a book, if I just decided to retire, I don't think I'd like that very much. I think I'll keep going as long as I can think and move my fingers.
How'd you get your break? How did you hook up with the right agent or the right publisher or both?
Well, I was in Ireland preparing for this single-handed yacht race, and I was building a boat, and the yacht designer, who had a book contract with a company in England, introduced me to his editor. They were Nautical Publishers, and they bought my unwritten memoir about the yacht race, and then they sold the American rights to that to W.W. Norton, and they ended up publishing my first novel, so I had a sort of progression. I tried selling it. There were three large publishers turned it down. At that point, it was with 100 pages and an outline, I think, and Norton bought it for the huge price of $7,500 at the time, and it did very well. It got a nice paperback sale. It was made into a television miniseries, which got very good critical reviews as well as high ratings, and it established me as a writer. Mm. And
That was it.
Never look back. Never.
That was the late Stuart Woods, who died on July 22nd, his only appearance on the program. And he came over to Yellow Springs to see us. He was on book tour, and he, at the time, had flown in his own private plane. Apparently, that's how he traveled. And during that interview, this part I removed when we did the editing, I mentioned to him that every time I walked into an airport, I would see his books on sale. And he said, oh, really? He goes, I never see that because I fly my own private plane and I don't go into airports. I don't see that kind of stuff. And I thought that was interesting that he was like that, lived in his own kind of cocoon. And quite an interesting guy. The only guy I can think of who used to do that besides him was Stephen Cannell, the creator of Rockford. He used to fly his own plane into Dayton. And we're going to bring you another Southern writer on the best of the Book Nook, a guy who was living in Alabama. His name is Michael Morris, and that's coming up following a break right here on your public radio station. We call it the Book Nook. The best of the Book Nook continues on 91.3 WYSO, connecting our community through news, music, and storytelling on the air and online. And back in 2003, when we had lots of authors coming through Dayton on book tour, we used to get a number of authors coming through on big tours who were not huge names. And one of them was a gentleman named Michael Morris, who came out here for an interview 19 years ago to talk about his novel, Slow Way Home. And when I pulled this out of the archive, I looked at it and I said, Michael Morris, I don't remember who that is. And so I listened to it. And number one, I loved his voice. He's got one of those beautiful Southern drawls. And another thing I really liked about the book and him was that a lot of this was inspired by his own life. This is a story of a troubled family. And apparently, Michael Morris grew up in a family much like it. Let's listen now to the best of the Book Nook as Michael Morris talks about his novel, Slow Way Home, on WYSO.
Slow Way Home, this little boy is tossed around between a drug-addicted mother, and he goes to live on this farm with his grandparents and has stability, and then she shows up out of the blue 2 years later wanting him back. And the courts agree with her. They're going to give him back even though she's not rehabilitated. And the grandparents take off. They flee with him to the panhandle of Florida and assume new identities.
So how did you get the idea for this?
Well, it actually came to me when I was working in the pharmaceutical industry, and I was in Fort Lauderdale on a business trip. And on the way back to the airport, I saw this RV park just stacked full of campers. And I looked at that and I thought, you know, somebody could get lost there. And then this image in my head of an older couple and this little boy came to mind. And I was drawn to that, but I didn't know where to go with it. You know, you got to have a conflict to get a story going. And I just kind of filed it away back in my mind. And lo and behold, about a year later, the Supreme Court looked at a case involving grandparents and custodial rights. And they ruled grandparents do not have any rights in this country. And so that's why I just took it to the next level.
They may not have any rights, but there are millions of them raising their grandkids, aren't there?
Yeah, this latest census shows that 2.4 million are raising their grandchildren in this country as primary caregivers. And, you know, when you look at that, these folks are doing so without any assistance from the government. In fact, there was a case that I heard of in Miami when the grandparents wanted to adopt the child. The child then lost eligibility for Medicaid and other government services. So this grandfather in the late 70s had to go and get a job to help make ends meet.
In your book, Brandon, your protagonist, this young boy, he doesn't know his daddy. His mom's had a series of boyfriends, some of them abusive. But he's confused. He loves his mama. And when they have the hearing with the judge, he's conflicted. He doesn't really know what to say. He doesn't know the right thing to say to make this all turn out okay, does he?
No, and that's what I tried to capture, is this confusion this boy has between this natural instinctive love of his mother and also this love of his grandparents who have been his bedrock of support. And, you know, often he has this daydream that they'll all be able to live under the same roof. And that comes up several times within the story. And at his heart, I think that's what he hopes for. Of course, reality is something different.
And when he comes home to his grandparents' farmhouse and they're sitting on the porch and he knows there's something wrong. Kids always know when there's something wrong. And this was the day that he finds out that his mom is going to be able to see him again after she's been lurking out there on the lane, parked out there in the car. It's all kind of eerie. He knows there's something wrong, but he can't deal with his emotions. Doesn't he just get in the car and start pretending he's driving the car and just tunes it out? He hardly ever cries, does he?
Yeah, he's not a crier, and he's become very good at masking his emotions. And the reason he jumps in that car and plays, basically, is just to show his grandparents that everything's okay and to some level trying to bring comfort to them, to know that he's going to be okay even though he's not inside. And that is something that that plays out throughout the novel, because I think he sees himself as a caregiver to his mother to some extent, too.
And he meets a little boy whose father has left him. His father's a Cuban. And there's a lot of mutual pain between the two kids, and they have a kinship in that way, but they can't really talk about it, can they?
No, they can't. And when Brandon tries to bring it up to that little boy who lives on a farm with his grandparents nearby, you know, the little boy actually kicks him in the flank with his cowboy boots, and he runs away. He just doesn't want to talk about it. And I think that's often the case. I know in my own personal history, my mom and I were in a situation of domestic abuse with my biological father. And we were fortunate to have the support of my grandparents to get us out. And we lived next door to them. And they provided me the stability and the sense of place that Brandon finds with his own grandparents. So some of that I was able to draw from with my own personal knowledge.
Well, it rings very true. And your flash on that park of campers and RVs connected you in some way with your own past, didn't it?
Yeah, and that's what's so neat about writing to me, is that you'll see things and it will spawn a story just by seeing this image. And to me, writing is a lot like having a movie in my mind. And as it unfolds, I just try to capture it on paper. And often it starts with a vision or image like that.
Let's look at some of these characters. Let's look at Brandon's mama. She's having a tough life, isn't she?
Yeah, she is a sad person. She doesn't realize that happiness comes from within. She's always trying to find somebody to bring her that happiness, whether it's a boyfriend or even Brandon himself. And she's never able to grasp that. But she's not totally evil in the story. I was conscious not to make her be just a completely evil person. She's got her own set of problems to deal with, and in fact, partly stem from her early years with her parents, Brandon's grandparents. And I think that also helps explains why these grandparents go to such length to help this child as a way to maybe cleanse the past and to see him as a legacy for them.
And a child, and I think probably particularly a little boy without a daddy, he's always feeling like there's something missing. Where is daddy?
Yeah, he's always wondering where his father is, and he has a air castle belief that his father is wealthy and his father's going to come and take him away and when the times get rough. And of course, as the story unfolds, he finds out that his father is someone that he's known all along. And
isn't that always the case?
Yeah, that's usually the way it is, yeah. I mean, you're surprised, you know?
Yeah, well, I'm not trying to give away any plot here, but you can reveal whatever you want, Michael. The grandparents, gotta love them.
Yeah, I really liked writing them, particularly Nana, the grandmother. I think there's a part of my own grandmother in her. And to me, that's what writing is like. It's like cooking. You take a little bit of this person, a little bit of somebody else, a little bit of another one, and you just make a composite. And that's what I usually try to do with all my characters. But the wisdom that Nana has in this story mirrors the wisdom that my grandmother had as well. Because when my mother and I left this abusive household and lived next door to them, my grandmother would often have me list out the people in my life who loved me. And of course, as a child, I didn't know what she was doing, and I would just list them out, and you know, she would add some to the list. And I pulled from that in the story to show that Nana is also doing that for Brandon, just as a way to remind him that he is loved and help provide security for him. And my mother was recently interviewed, the first time she's ever been interviewed about either one of these books. And she made a statement that I thought was pretty profound. She said, you know, had her mother been born in a different era, she would have been a counselor. And she was very much a counselor to our family. And I think Nana in this story is such a person, too, because when they end up in Abbeville with Brandon, Nana becomes a mentor to Benita, the single mother there, trying to raise two boys and seeks to help others.
She doesn't start off single, though, but we won't talk about that. We'll leave some surprises for the readers.
Yeah.
There's a lot in this book, and we all go through troubled times, emotional times, difficult family experiences, and I think reading stuff like this can be very helpful.
Well, I hope, and that's one thing that I want to get across to people, that when I read a novel, personally, I don't like to read a novel that's going to leave me depressed at the end. I want to at least know there's hope. That doesn't mean the facts can be whitewashed. I'm not saying that. I just want to know that the character is on his or her way. And when you get to the end of Slow Way Home, I hope that people will find it a novel of hope and redemption, because that's what I intended to write.
So you're old-fashioned. Is that what you're telling us?
A little bit.
You remember when movies always had a happy ending?
Yeah.
You're too young to remember that. My guess is Michael Morris. The book is Slow Way Home. We don't want to give short shrift to the grandpa. He's a great guy.
Yeah, he is. And he provides protection of Brandon as well. And he's a little more lighthearted. He brings some fun into the situation. He's Brandon's fishing buddy. And he's a character who changes in the story too. And I think slowly unfolds. Starts off a little on the racist side. And then because of this African-American minister named Sister Dolores, who has a big impact on the family and helps the community, he starts to come around.
A lot of us have driven south through Georgia and Florida. I've never been to Alabama, but I'm guessing it's probably kind of the same way when you're driving along. And you see those roadside stands. They're selling boiled peanuts and ladies selling junk, you know, a woman with a bad wig. You've created quite a character here.
Yeah, you're talking about Mama Rose.
Yeah.
Who runs the Eternal Yard Sale on the side of the highway. Yeah, she was fun to write. Boy, she's a nut. But, you know, God love her. She makes the South what it is. You know, who was it who said the difference between the North and the South is that we leave our crazy relatives on the front porch and in the North they're hidden in the attic? You know, I think there's a lot of truth to that.
In the South, they hide other stuff in the attic, Michael.
That's right, the secrets.
That's my favorite scene in the whole book.
With Mama Rose.
They're helping her move stuff out of the attic. That's my favorite in the whole book.
Yeah.
Of course, you have to read the book to find out why. We have a lot of things lurking in the shadows in this book, don't we?
Yeah, a lot of secrets unfold there. But Mama Rose was a fun character to write because I see those stands all the time. And what she does, of course, is she goes and buys secondhand goods from the tourist stores in Panama City who've maybe been damaged in a fire or whatnot. And she'll load them in her car and haul them back to Abbeville and sell them on the side of Highway 27 there. And she gets unsuspecting tourists who come passing through town to stop and purchase her goods. And she's actually the grandmother to two of Brandon's friends in Abbeville. And her family was very active in the Klan. And that unfolds in this. And Brandon, for the first time, really begins to see somebody who is a racist up close and personal and has an impact on him. For me, when the writing is the best is when I'm just writing for myself and not trying to look at it as pleasing an editor, pleasing the agent to sell it. I mean, it has to start for you. And when I wrote my first novel, the big release for me is when I stopped worrying about getting it published and quit thinking about that and quit really going to these writing programs where they talked about how to get published. And I just decided I'm going to write this. And if nothing else, it'd be a piece of immortality left of me that maybe some distant relative will find down the road in the attic and in a box. And they'll be able to get an insight on who I was and see that I wrote this story.
It seems to me that a lot of really good writing happens when there's no pressure.
I agree, 100%.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, reprising an interview I recorded back in 2003 with a writer who was living in Alabama. His name's Michael Morris, and his novel was Slow Way Home. And we'll bring you more of that conversation right after this. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, going back to 2003 for an interview I did with Michael Morris, a writer from the South with a lovely Southern accent, talking about his novel, Slow Way Home.
When you were a kid, did you ever think maybe you'd be a writer, or did you have any idea what you wanted to be?
I had no idea, and I came to this through the back door. I wasn't even a big reader growing up. I was a big TV watcher, unfortunately. I wish I would have read more. But really, a turning point for me came when I was a junior in high school, and I had this teacher who asked us to write an essay, I'll never forget it, Where I'll Be When I Turn 30. Of course, that seemed so ancient at the time. But while reading those essays, she stopped when she came to mind, and she looked at me, and she said, you have talent. And it's the first time I've been told that I could do anything academically well, because until then, I was not a good student. And I thought, well, I'll write business reports or memos. I mean, again, to me, a writer did not come from Perry, Florida, and I didn't have the background of what I thought a writer should have. She and I kept a close friendship, and she always encouraged me to write, and she actually was diagnosed with brain cancer last September, and Slow Way Home is dedicated to her. Her name's Linda Maltzby, and the last time I got to see Linda was when I showed her the advance copy of this novel, and she got to see the dedication page. So I'm very grateful for that. But she was a big encourager to me. And it just showed me, too, how powerful words could be in a positive, because I'd had words be negative on me in the past. And so this was the first time I think they had a major positive influence on me.
Is she gone?
Yeah, she passed away in June.
I notice a lot of books are very formulaic. A lot of books are just cranked out, and they're bestsellers, and you read them, and they follow a formula. They try to shake it up a little bit, but there's a formula there. And one thing that I really enjoyed about this book is that it's not gratuitously written, in that you'll be reading, and you'll just make an observation about something going on in the distance, in nature. A bird flew by, or you know, this is by the side of the road, or whatever. And those little touches really mean a lot, I think, to the reader.
Well, that's good to hear. I think it stems from me seeing this as a movie again in my head, and just capturing those details. Because when it's flowing, I'm trying to keep up on the keyboard with it. And that's why I only write on the keyboard, because if I try to write longhand, it's running so fast in my head that I have a hard time trying to catch up on paper. So I use the keyboard for that reason.
And that's a computer?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You an early morning writer? You have a certain time that you set aside every day?
I am early morning, because when I wrote the first novel, I was working 9 to 5, and I would get up early in the morning and work on the story, and then work on it on the weekends. And I found that that's what works best for me. You know, I would go to these writers' events, or at the bookstore, a reading, and the writer would say, oh, I work late at night. Well, then I try to work late at night. You know, I do everything that they said they did. And then, you know, what I found out is I'm an early morning person. There's something about that sense of day before the sun comes up. There's a stillness there. There's a stillness in the house that lets you just slip away into this other world and capture it on paper.
I have a friend who does a weblog every day for a fairly significant publication, online publisher, and he says he has to do it early in the morning because you get too distracted the rest of the day, you don't get it done.
Yeah, that's me, 100%. And we live in this small town now, Fairhope, Alabama. And, you know, around 9:30, people are coming to the door or calling, and, hey, I love being around people. I'm going to slip down there and visit with them, and half the day is gone before I realize it. So, you know, for me, that's how I keep my discipline and keep my focus, is just doing that early morning work.
For a long time, I had this theory that Southern writers are so often really exceptional because there was something in the water. Well, recently I've changed my mind about that, and I think it's something in the dirt.
Oh, the dirt.
Yeah. You have any comments on that?
Well, I don't eat dirt.
Some people do down there, right? Some people do.
I've heard of that. I've never seen it, but I don't eat dirt. But, no, I don't know what that is.
It's the soil is what I'm saying. It's, for instance, recently I had a guy on with a book called Measuring America, and it's all about how the United States was measured when they did the Louisiana Purchase and all. And he said down south, they used a system called meets and bounds, which they didn't use in the rest of the country. And he said, because of this system of measurement of the land and the topography, that is why down south, people are still fighting over boundaries. People are still fighting over land, and they've been fighting over it for hundreds of years. And I guess that's what I mean about it being in the ground. It's,
yeah.
It created a different kind of a culture down there.
Yeah, well, it definitely did. And that's what I explore in this novel, too, because while the majority of the novel takes place in the early 70s, at the end, Brandon, as an adult man, comes back to try to save a portion of this farm from development. And I wanted to explore that because while living in North Carolina, development was a huge issue. It was one that policymakers were beginning to take a look at. And for so long in the South, we have been land rich and money poor. And with more people coming into the Southeast now, that's beginning to change. But I wanted to explore at what cost, because I really do think there is a cost to giving that up. You're giving up a piece of your heritage and a piece of who you are as well to fill the bank account.
My guess is Michael Morris. Where did you live in North Carolina?
I lived in Raleigh, where this novel is set.
Okay. My old school roommate was from Southern Pines, which is kind of...
I know it well. I was just there a couple of weeks ago at the bookstore.
Yeah, that's right over by Pinehurst.
Yeah, beautiful area.
Yeah, beautiful. I love North Carolina.
I do too.
Haven't spent much time there, but I'd like to. I hear Asheville's a very nice place.
It's a gorgeous state. I mean, you know, in Raleigh, that's what we liked about it. 3 hours to the mountains, 3 hours to the coast. So it's the best of both worlds. But the development issue was a hot topic there, and it's one I just wanted to explore. Because when I used to drive to work to this big pharmaceutical company, you know, you'd pass a farmhouse on the side of the road. Well, then a week later, it was gone, and a bulldozer was tearing up the land, and soon there would be a development there or a strip mall. And I just thought, wow, you know, and I'm not trying to say I'm not for progress, but it's just, to me, in a way, sad to think of the memories that are tied to that house and to that land that's probably been passed down for generations. And what do you do with that when there's development sitting on top of it now?
Hey, go ahead. Say you're not for progress, because sometimes progress takes us right down a rat hole.
Yeah.
And you talked about, you came into the studio and you said, this is such a beautiful little town. This is such a beautiful little community, Yellow Springs. And people have had to fight to preserve that. In fact, a few years ago, this was a national story. It was covered in the New York Times here in Yellow Springs. There's a part of town just on the edge of town that has a great big farm on it, and the woman that owned it had been in her family for many years, and it basically created a buffer which kind of kept development from coming that way into the village. And she passed away, and her kids, who lived in Florida, wanted to parcel it out and sell it to developers and turn it into a whole bunch of luxury homes, like a big suburban kind of sprawl thing. And people in this town got together. That's why it was a national story. And they fought it, and they ended up buying all the land and turning it into green space and leaving it a farm and left it alone, and they're not allowing it to be developed. And the buffer is still there, but people had to stand up and say, I don't like this. And this doesn't happen very often.
Not often at all. Yeah, I've never heard of that happening. That's an amazing story.
Well, apparently the auctioneer, who was from Indiana, was flabbergasted by all this. He couldn't believe it, because people were marching down the street with signs. I mean, this is quite a little town here.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And I've had friends who've had this happen, and what I think, when people start throwing big dollars around and you haven't had it, I mean, that it's easy to lose focus sometimes.
Yeah, sure is. You got more books coming out? You got
I
more,
do.
More you're working on there?
I have one that I'm working on right now. I'm about halfway through with it. And it's about the oldest serving sheriff in Alabama, who at 83 has lost election. And he has to deal with losing control over this county that he's ruled with an iron fist, and also control over his family. And he gets put into assisted living, and he rebels. He leaves and starts hitchhiking his way out, and he ends up going to this town where his cousin lived, that he's lost contact with. Well, of course, when he gets there, the cousin's long gone, and the citrus grove the man owned is now a strip mall. But he decides to stay and explore this next chapter in his life. And this migrant family there helps him come to terms with an issue that's kept a distance between he and his children, particularly his daughter.
And this is another product of your imagination, just kind of popped out?
It did. What helped inspire this story is my own grandfather, who's 93, lost his license last year because of macular degeneration. I mean, this man's very strong-willed and independent. And I saw the impact that had on him. And I just took that and ran with it and, you know, took it to the next level, so to speak.
How did they break it to him that he was losing his license?
It wasn't easy. They debated about it over and over, my mother and her two brothers and sister. And finally what happened is when it came time for renewal, they basically said, we're not going to be able to renew the license. And so then my uncles and aunt and mother moved swiftly to look into selling the truck because he would have driven it.
Sure.
License or no license.
That was a tough generation. My dad had a stroke probably 20 years ago, and he recovered from it. He continued to drive, and he went from being a really safe, really cautious driver to a driver who became rather temperamental. And if you walked across the street in front of him, he took that personally, and he had a great big Cadillac he was driving. And when he pulled into a parking place, he expected the cars that were parked around where he wanted to park to be sort of yielding to him, so he would pull any kind of ricochet off of them. And finally we said, look, Dad, we said, you're going to hurt somebody. You can't be driving anymore. I know that's a big point of pride. It's a big point of independence for you, but you can't drive. And he refused. He said, I will continue to drive, and there's nothing you can do about it. So we didn't know what to do because we were afraid someone was going to get really badly hurt or killed. And so knowing my father and his values, one day I saw this police car that was parked up the block from his house, and a policewoman and a policeman were in it, and they were checking into something or other. And I went up to him, and I said, can you do me a favor? And they said, okay. And I explained the situation with my dad, and they went up to my dad's house and knocked on the door, and they said, sir, we understand that, you know, you've been driving, you know, in a sort of a hazardous fashion, and we really think that you should probably stop driving. And he was upset about it, but he just said, whatever, officer. You know, I mean, he respected authority, and he said, I understand. He never questioned how this came about.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. He turned in his license.
Oh, well, you all were fortunate.
Well, I was afraid, because I'd ride with him in his car.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's scary. I remember riding with my grandfather one time. He was borrowing my aunt's car and ran off the road, and I was just panicked trying to reach over the steering wheel. And when he got the car back in control, he looked at me and said, you realize I only did that because I'm not familiar with this car.
I was going to the mall one time with my grandmother, and she was starting to kind of lose it. And they have these cut-throughs and big lanes of traffic where you cut through and turn into the mall. And she cut through and then started driving the wrong way in the other lane. And car full of little kids. I said, Grandma, turn,
yeah,
turn.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite author?
Lee Smith. No doubt about it. Not only because of her kindness, but I say her kindness shines as brightly as her talent. She's a wonderful writer, and some of the images she uses in her work, I mean, they stay with me right now. I still see them in my head.
You've been listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO. That was Michael Morris. I love that interview, talking about his novel, Slow Way Home. And tune in tomorrow. We'll bring you the Book Nook again, as we always do on Sunday morning at 10:30, with a completely different interview than the one you just heard. And tomorrow, best-selling novelist Linda Castillo will join me to talk about her latest novel of suspense. She sets these in the Amish country of Ohio. It's called The Hidden One. It's already a bestseller. And I reviewed the book recently in the Dayton Daily News. And earlier, I had written a piece saying that this book was going to be coming out, and I made the mistake of mentioning that it was set in Pennsylvania instead of Ohio. And
Oh, my, you could hear the howls. Apparently, there are many, many fans of this series out there, and they wrote me and they told me in emails, Vic, you really blew it that time, man. These are set in Ohio, but the story is set in Pennsylvania. So there. Linda Castillo will be my guest tomorrow, talking about The Hidden One in the Book Nook, 10:30, Sunday morning, right here on your public radio station, WYSO.